Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
They thought it was the perfect crime until the body was found. You're listening to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, featuring psychotherapist and author Siobhan Scott.
Picture this. You are convicted of murder, but the evidence against you is so confusing that even dirt and headphones are arguing in the prosecution's timeline. Now throw in an alternative suspect who confessed, allegedly, years earlier, and suddenly the whole case feels kind of like a horrible true crime Dateline episode. Well, it already has been, and it really is. With all this chaos, let's get into the psychology of what's going on in the case of Richard Allen. What happens to someone mentally when they're caught in a storm of uncertainty and a courtroom that can't seem to make up its mind? Joining me to discuss where things are at right now, Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author on this case, which continues to baffle now that the prosecution is sitting there and the defense is going, we got a couple things that we need to run by you all, and we need to run this by an appeals court because some of this stuff doesn't feel very right. Siobhan, let's start with all of that. Just so many things coming up in this case. Obviously, the trial didn't go extremely smooth. The waiting up to the trial and the procedural motions had so many issues, and a lot of that's being brought up now. But what has got to be going through the mind of someone like Richard Allen? And let's assume for a moment he didn't do this, where it seems the stakes are 100% stacked against you, and it's really hard just to get basic facts out because no one seems to want to hear them.
Well, goes without saying, this would be very demoralizing and deeply depressing to any of us. And I think with his fragile mental health, which we've seen lots of evidence of that, it's got to be hell for the guy. And as we know, he has suffered with extreme psychosis, the severe symptoms, beating his head against the wall, eating feces, all this awful stuff. I would anticipate that that kind of deterioration could be ongoing for him. And, you know, so much about this case was built upon his psychotic confessions. And what we know about psychosis is that a psychotic confession should not be considered a confession.
And that's one of the big things that is being brought up into this case. But there's several other issues that are being brought up. The alleged illegal custody transfer of him from one location to another without notifying the attorneys. That's becoming something that they're bringing up in appeals. The prosecutorial misconduct regarding false testimony. There was some of that in the case, specifically talking about that alleged van, which we never really knew where to place it or how it was because it never really made a whole lot of sense. But the prosecution just kind of went forward was, well, there must be a van there. An alternative suspect confession. This is a big one, and this is a new one I want to talk about for just a second, because this is something that never made it into court. This is one of those things that Judge Gull said, I don't think we need that for this case when, you know, you have an alternative suspect theory. Maybe you should look at it, especially if it's someone else who confessed that wasn't in solitary confinement for a year straight before you got that out of him. The guy even said that they used a box cutter as a weapon. We don't know who this is, but it is another piece that never made it into trial. The family of Richard Allen, Richard himself, there's so many pieces here. When it's sitting in front of you, that's got to be beyond stressful to think about if this is your husband that's behind bars. How are you trying to cope with something like this?
Yeah, I don't think we have a formula for that. This is just in that category of unimaginable kind of circumstances. And it's just got to be hell for everybody involved.
Could prolonged incarceration without proper legal representation kind of create a sense of helplessness that's going to really impact his mental state? Is that how you think he kind of got to the place where he was? We heard so many stories of the attorneys just having difficulty even communicating with him while he was behind bars initially, trying to speak through the little flap in the door where they give you food. I mean, it's almost like something out of a movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is one of the strangest cases. And I think, you know, we all feel satisfied at the end of a trial when we feel like, you know, the bad guy got what they deserve and they're punished. And actually the human neural pathways light up when we see somebody who's a norm violator punished, you know, so that's a sense of satisfaction. And I don't think anybody, well, most people don't have that sense of satisfaction about this case. It's this sense of something being off.
Well, a lot of people on the outside don't have that sense of satisfaction, but people on the inside seem to. I mean, it seems to be that a lot of things, I mean, on the outside, you look and go, it looks like you're really pushing things this certain direction. I'm wondering if those who were in the sandbox doing all of this and playing this case, essentially, do you think that there was some sort of railroading going on here, or was this just really a cognitive bias that started in one place and just kind of grew and grew and grew, and they're all on this team and Richard's over here on that team, and we are going to take you down no matter what, because it becomes more of a, I guess, of a battle of who has the best arguments, who's going to be the loudest really in this case, versus what is the truth.
Yeah, I think sometimes you do see where there are, you know, corrupt conspiracies, you know, in prosecuting someone. But I think most of the time, cognitive bias is the perfect term. People get sold on a story, they buy into the story completely, and then it becomes all about proving their version of the story, and this sense of it's us versus them and our team versus the other team, and we've got to win here. So that's how they start looking at it.
I know, I mean, psychologically, this is your area. How difficult is it in a case like this? Because we have a really interesting setup here where the potential killer, if you look down some of the other theories, could be dead. Ron Logan is one of the individuals who had the property where the girls were found at. He had a bit of a history, but he's not with us anymore. There's other folks that are alive, but you have, you know, him as being one of the possible prime suspects. The FBI was even initially going, hey, we really have to look at him, but the locals said, we got this. Trust us, we'll get the right guy. And clearly, all that information is gone. Even if you were to get a new set of investigators to come here and look at this, or get just a new court to look at this, a new prosecution to look at this, do you think it will be seen in a different light than the initial round of this? And how difficult is that to really impact a case when someone's dead? They can't speak their reality or what they'd like you to believe, truth or fake. And you do have one person over here who did make confessions, but you have these other people here who are not around anymore.
Right, right. Yeah, that's one of the nightmares about, you know, so many of these weird cases that we end up trying to sort through. If there's no DNA, it's not like the Koberger case where you've got DNA and that, you know, gives you something nice and solid. When there's just so much speculation and as you say, the alternate suspect theories and possibilities and people that are dead, we may never know. You know, we may never come to a satisfying conclusion on this, which is just awful.
And what do you do in a case like that? I mean, it is where we're sitting right now. I mean, that does not reach the level of you know, beyond a reasonable doubt. There's a lot of reasonable doubt here. I think most people would argue that. But we have a person that's away now for the rest of their life as it sits. That's not really how it's supposed to work when you have scenarios like this. How does someone like Richard Allen, who we've already seen deteriorate the way that he did the first several years in custody and also being treated very differently, being in solitary confinement. How does someone like that, and can someone like that, survive going forward through all of this? Or does it make it easier at this point now that the big initial game is over? Maybe there'll be another one. Maybe there won't. But to keep himself sane, is that going to be a challenge, seeing his already, you know, seemingly fragile state in this case?
Yeah, he's going to remain fragile. You know, he was diagnosed with a dependent personality disorder, which is not the same as being a criminal or a psychopath or anything like that. It's a person who's kind of fragile and needy. And that's who he is. And so I would think if he's going to survive, he's going to need a lot of emotional support. And is he getting that? Will he get that? I don't know. So looking at it from that angle, it's just really tragic.
Does a personality like that, have you seen historically, is that someone who, I mean, obviously it can be anybody, but is that someone who typically would commit crimes of this nature with this sort of, I guess, you know, a gusto, walking into the woods one day, deciding to take out two little girls that you don't know are going to be there? I mean, it's just, I don't know. I mean, number one, it doesn't really line up with his personality, but if you have a disorder of some sort, that can change the game. What does that say to you about propensity to commit a crime like this with what we do know about his mental health?
Yeah, good question. You know, it certainly has happened where you see folks with dependent traits, you know, commit violent crimes, but it's not common. It's not typical. Usually we think more of the psychopathic person with impulse control problems, anger problems, as we've talked about before, the hidden dark side of their sexual behavior that shows up on their internet searching. None of that was found here. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's an unusual case from that angle too.
So many questions. We'll see where it goes now. It's really going to be argued in the courts, not even so much about anything mentally, but just what was done wrong. I'd imagine we're going to see another trial, but I guess time will tell.
Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
You're in the thick of a true crime saga, every detail sinking in. And then, wham, a commercial about something you couldn't care less about. It's like being served a microwaved dinner at a five-star restaurant. But it doesn't have to be this way. Go for True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts. With True Crime Today Premium Plus, you get uninterrupted, ad-free episodes, extended interviews that dig even deeper into the muck, and early access so you can brag to your friends. It's like ordering the secret menu at a crime buffet. So, search for True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and savor every twisted detail without interruption.